Imagine you are standing on the catwalk of a pristine, perfectly organized factory.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right. It is this marvel of modern engineering. And you look down and you see raw materials coming in at one end, dropping neatly onto a conveyor belt.
Nice and orderly.
Exactly. They move steadily down the line, getting stamped, sorted, assembled, until this finished, polished product just drops off the other end. It is clean, it's linear, and, it makes total logical sense.
Right. It's comforting, honestly. We desperately like to think of systems, especially our own minds, actually as being binary and straightforward like that.
For sure.
Like input leads to processing, and processing neatly leads to output.
Yeah, exactly. But then you step off that catwalk and you try to actually live your life.
Right, which is always the problem.
Always. You try to focus on a really complex problem at work, or you try to change a stubborn habit, and suddenly you realize that beautiful factory floor is just on fire.
Total chaos.
The conveyor belt is running backward, the sorting machine is actively throwing things at the wall, and the finished product looks absolutely nothing like what went in.
Not even close.
So we are looking at a cognitive landscape that is, well, honestly, it's murky and chaotic.
Is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters.
Yeah.
And that illusion, the illusion of the linear mind, is perhaps one of the most stubborn and really counterproductive myths we carry about ourselves.
And that is exactly what we are here to dismantle today. So welcome to this deep dive. Today, our mission is to shortcut you to a profound understanding of how you actually process information, how you learn, and how you act in a world where your brain has strictly limited resources.
Which is pretty much every day for all of us.
Oh, 100%. We are basing our deep dive today on a dense, cutting-edge theoretical corpus detailing what researchers call the cognitive event operator architecture, or CEOA for short.
Right, and setting the baseline here is crucial for how we move forward. The CEOA is what we call a minimal formal system.
Which sounds incredibly intimidating, by the way.
I know, it sounds like intense jargon. But it just means it doesn't rely on mystical theories of consciousness or, try to locate the exact metaphysical soul in your brain.
Okay, so it's more grounded.
Exactly. It is a highly practical, dynamic framework. It explains the brutal mechanics of how our minds juggle an endless barrage of inputs.
Like a flashing phone screen.
Right, or even an internal input, like a lingering childhood memory. And it does all of this while operating on a very strict, unforgiving energy budget.
So, to understand this new framework, I feel like we first have to really look at why that old factory model is so deeply broken. Like, why doesn't A just lead to B and then C?
Well, the temptation of that linear chain is undeniable. We love to draw it on whiteboards, right? Like input leads to thought, which leads to action.
Yeah, it looks great on a PowerPoint.
It really does. But the CEOA text points out that human cognition has fundamentally anti-linear features. First off, there is circularity.
Meaning what? Exactly, like a feedback loop.
It's exactly like a feedback loop.
Yeah.
Your past actions literally change your future environments, which then change your future inputs.
Give me an example of that.
Okay, so if you decide to yell at someone, the environment changes immediately, right? And the very next input you receive is them yelling back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a straight line at all. It's a circle. Second, there is memory feedback. Your current state of mind reaches back in time and biases what you even allow yourself to pay attention to in the first place.
That is wild.
And third, there are multiple aggressive bottlenecks. The system is constrained by limited processing power at every single step of the journey.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. So the mind isn't a factory assembly line where raw materials go in one end and finished actions come out the other. It's more like a bustling, interconnected city grid where a traffic jam in one neighborhood completely reroutes behavior in another entirely different part of
I
town.
love that analogy. In a city grid, if a delivery doesn't arrive, you don't just throw up your hands and say, well, the whole city is broken.
Right, you'd look for the specific problem.
Exactly. You look for the specific intersection where the traffic stopped. The CEOA introduces this mathematical concept of the system state, which they label as S sub T.
S sub T.
Yes, but practically speaking, what it argues is that a failure in cognition or a failure to take action is almost never a single point of failure.
So it's not just like, oops, my brain broke.
No, it is not just a vague, oh, I wasn't paying attention, or I just have no willpower today.
Right.
It is a mechanical breakdown somewhere in a dynamically coupled ecosystem.
Right. So if the delivery didn't arrive, maybe the truck broke down, or maybe the bridge was out, or maybe the driver just got the wrong address.
Precisely.
But if the mind isn't a straight line, what are the actual pieces of this city grid? Because I feel like you and I, and probably everyone listening, use terms like attention and understanding interchangeably all the time.
Most of us do, yeah. And that is where the architecture provides immense clarity. It breaks cognition down into distinct functional operators.
Okay, what are they?
You have selection, which is how you allocate your limited resources. You have observation, which is how you form an internal representation of what you just selected.
Right.
You have updating, which is whether that representation actually changes your internal beliefs. And finally, you have action gating, which decides if you actually do something about it.
So it's four totally separate things.
Yes. The corpus explicitly untangles these to stop us from mixing them up.
Let's actually walk through a real-world scenario with these operators, because when I read this in the sources, it completely blew my mind.
Yeah.
Let's talk about selection versus observation.
Okay, let's do it.
Because the text says that just because an event gets your attention, just because you allocate cognitive resources to it, does not mean you form a correct representation of it.
That's right.
Wait, really? So I can stare at a complex spreadsheet at work, actively selecting it, giving it all my attention, my eyes are tracking the cells, but completely fail to observe or understand the financial story it's telling.
Exactly. Let's use a metaphor here. Selection is just the granting of access. It is the bouncer letting a guest into a really noisy nightclub.
Okay, I like that.
But observation is whether the bartender can actually understand the guest's drink order over the loud music.
Oh, wow.
You allocated the space the bouncer let the spreadsheet into your cognitive club, but your observation operator failed to build a structural model of what the data was actually asking for.
That makes so much sense. I've always blamed myself for losing focus, but I wasn't losing focus. The bouncer was doing his job.
Exactly. The bartender was just confused.
Right.
Precisely.
Right.
And it goes deeper. The text untangles observation from updating.
Okay, how so?
You can see a counterexample to your deeply held belief. You can completely understand that counterexample, meaning the bartender heard the order perfectly, your observation operator is working fine, but your internal belief system completely refuses to update.
So I see the data, I completely understand the data, and my brain just says, no thanks, I'm rejecting this.
Yes, because updating is a separate operator with its own massive energy costs and its own thresholds.
That's frustrating, honestly.
It is. And then we get to the final disconnect. Action does not equal impact, and impact does not equal cognitive correctness.
Wait, break that down for me.
You can take an action that has zero external impact because the environment just wasn't receptive.
Mm.
Or conversely, a completely erroneous, biased belief can drive an action that somehow has massive world-changing impact.
So stumbling into success in the real world doesn't retroactively prove that your observation of reality was actually correct.
Right.
You might have just gotten lucky.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture,
mm-hmm.
decoupling these concepts is incredibly empowering for you as the listener.
Yeah, I can see that.
It prevents us from blaming every single failure on a generic lack of focus or lack of intelligence.
Yeah.
If you can't figure out that spreadsheet, it's not because you weren't trying hard enough. It's because the observation operator is lacking the prior models to decode it. You shift from a moral judgment like, oh, I am lazy, to a structural diagnostic.
Hmm.
You can find the exact bottleneck in your mental city grid.
Okay, let's unpack this. Now that we see these distinct operators acting like, you know, different intersections in the city grid, where does memory fit?
That is the golden question.
Because I think most of us assume memory is just the final storage box at the end of the factory line. You experience something, you think about it, you act on it, and then you just file the receipt away in a cabinet for later.
And the CEOA text takes an absolute sledgehammer to that filing cabinet.
Oh, I love that.
This is a central foundational focus of the entire theoretical corpus. Memory is not the final layer in a sequence. It is a cross-layer transversal interface.
A transversal interface. Explain that. What does that actually mean?
It means memory isn't sitting passively at the end of the process. It is aggressively interwoven into every single step. It influences selection, meaning we naturally pay attention to things based on our historical habits. It influences observation. We literally interpret ambiguous shapes or words based on prior models stored in memory.
Right, right.
And it heavily influences action, because we act based on the procedural memory of what worked before. Memory is constantly pinging every other operator at all times.
So if memory isn't a hard drive we read static files from, is it more like a background operating system?
Yes.
Like it's constantly whispering to our senses and actively reconstructing reality based on our current mood or our current context.
That is exactly it. Memory is reconstruction, not retrieval of an exact copy.
That is wild to think about.
Every time you recall a past event, you are rebuilding it on the fly, using the raw materials of your current state, your current environment, and the specific cues present right now. The text breaks this down by highlighting 5 distinct states of memory to prove that a memory isn't just a static file.
I really want to dig into those 5 states. What are they?
Okay, the 5 states are existence, accessibility, retrievability, reportability, and actionability.
Okay, slow down. That's a lot.
I know, but they are functionally completely different thresholds. Just because a memory exists as a physical trace in your neural network does not mean it is structurally accessible in the moment.
Wait, so what is the difference between existing and being accessible?
Think of existence as a book that was printed and placed somewhere in a massive library.
Okay, the book is in the building.
Right. Accessibility means the pathway to that specific aisle is intact, like the bridge isn't burned down, the door isn't locked.
Got it.
But just because the pathway is intact doesn't mean you can retrieve the book. Retrievability means you actually have the contextual key, the specific sensory cue, to unlock it right now.
Oh, like when a word is on the tip of your tongue.
Yes.
It exists, the pathway is accessible, but you literally cannot retrieve it until someone gives you the first letter. That first letter is the cue.
Exactly. You are missing the retrieval cue.
Mm-hmm.
And moving down the chain, just because you can retrieve it internally doesn't mean you can report it or translate it into language for someone else.
Right, like trying to explain a complex dream. You know what happened, but the words just fail you.
Spot on. And most importantly, just because you can report it does not mean it is actionable under pressure.
Okay, give me an example of that, because that sounds critical.
Okay, you might be able to calmly explain the safety procedures of a plane crash while sitting on your couch in your living room.
Sure, I can recite the pamphlet.
Right, you have the declarative memory. But that does not automatically transfer to procedural actionability when you're actually in a fuselage and the cabin is filling with smoke.
Wow, that distinction is terrifying, but also really validating. Which leads me to a huge question.
Guess you.
If memory is this active operating system constantly reconstructing the past to update our present, why does it sometimes whisper the exact wrong thing? Like, why do some people, or let's be honest, why do we get utterly stuck in our beliefs or stuck in repeating bad habits despite overwhelming new evidence? If the system is designed to update, why does it freeze?
This is where the CEOA introduces a brilliant concept called the dual axis model. Historically, psychology sometimes classified thoughts as hot or cold based on how often they were updated.
Right.
But the CEOA argues that's a flawed single axis. Instead, we must look at 2 independent variables, activation versus plasticity.
Okay, activation and plasticity. Break those down for us.
Activation is the extent to which an event or a belief is accessible and actively running in your current processing space. Think of it as volume.
Kind of how loud it is in your head.
Yes, how loudly and how often are you thinking about it. Plasticity, on the other hand, is update gain. It is how sensitive that belief is to being changed when you are presented with new evidence or a prediction error.
Ah, I see. Think of a stubborn relative at a holiday dinner, right? Or even just yourself getting stuck in a really negative, anxious thought loop.
We've all been there.
So you're saying a thought can be highly active, like it is burning hot in your mind, you are obsessing over a mistake you made all day long, but it can have 0 plasticity, meaning it is completely frozen, rigid, and absolutely immune to logic or new data.
What's fascinating here is that this exact dynamic, high activation, coupled with low plasticity, mathematically explains stereotypes, rigid political narratives, and clinical rumination.
That is incredible.
You are constantly retrieving the memory, the volume is at maximum, but the update operator is completely gated off.
But I'm stuck on plasticity. Why? If you are thinking about it so much, if the volume is that loud, shouldn't that sheer repetition force your brain to process it and update it? Why does it just freeze?
Because of what the text calls the identity defense load.
Identity defense load.
Yes. If a belief is load-bearing for your sense of self, if admitting you are wrong about a political stance or a past relationship means your entire identity might collapse, the cognitive cost of updating is too high.
The ego cost is too expensive.
Exactly. The action gate for the update operator slams shut. Your cognitive state is essentially frozen in a loop. You're highly exposed to the topic, but your system engages in defensive closure to protect the core identity.
Wow. So it's not that they or we are ignoring the topic. We aren't burying our heads in the sand. We are highly active on it. We are just structurally refusing the plasticity because it's too expensive to our ego. That is a massive paradigm shift.
It completely reframes how we communicate and argue. If you want to change someone's mind, increasing the activation, yelling at them more, showing them more data, forcing them to look at the issue will not work if their plasticity is at absolute zero.
Right, you're just turning up the volume on a broken speaker.
Exactly. You have to lower the identity defense load first. You have to make it safe for them to update.
So what does this all mean for our physical behaviors? We have explored how thoughts get frozen in this high activation and low plasticity trap. But what happens when we do manage to update our beliefs?
Right, when things go right.
Yeah, like we have the right data, we lowered the defense load, we genuinely want to change, yet we still completely fail to take action.
This brings us to the ultimate bottleneck in the CEOA framework, knowledge action transfer dynamics.
Okay.
The journey from simply knowing something to actually doing it is a perilous multi-stage translation process. The text proves definitively that knowing and doing are not bridged by a magical, simple thing called willpower.
Right, the classic, I know I should go to the gym, I genuinely want to go to the gym, but for some reason, I am still sitting on the couch eating chips dilemma.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's trace that gym dilemma through the interfaces. First, there is knowledge existence. The information that exercise is good exists in your neural network.
Check.
Second, retrieval. You are actively thinking about it right now on the couch.
Check again.
But then you hit the third interface, procedural availability.
Meaning, do I actually know how to do the thing I want to do?
Yes. Do you actually have a mapped out procedure? Do you know where your gym shoes are? What exact route you will run? What machines you will use? If the procedure isn't immediately available, the cognitive load spikes and the transfer breaks.
Okay, but let's say I have my shoes, I have my routine, it's all laid out. I still might not go.
Then you look at the fourth interface, cue activation. Is the current context triggering the action?
What do you mean?
If you hid your running shoes in the back of a dark closet instead of putting them right by the front door, the environmental sensory cue is missing. Without the cue, the transfer breaks again.
And if the shoes are right by the door, staring me in the face.
And you face the final boss of the architecture, action gating.
The final boss. I love that.
The researchers use this math variable, G sub T, for the action gate. But what it really represents is a ruthless internal accountant.
Okay. An accountant doing what?
Is an algorithm sitting there weighing the expected value of your goal against immediate aversive costs, delayed rewards, and perceived risks. If the immediate aversive costs the feeling of the cold air outside, the burn in your lungs is calculated by this accountant as heavier in the immediate present than the abstract delayed reward of long-term health. The gate closes. Execution is zero.
Think about how much guilt we carry every day over this exact thing. We internalize it so much.
We really do.
We tell ourselves, I'm lazy, or I have no discipline, or I'm a failure. But if you look at this through the CEOA framework, you aren't morally flawed.
Not at all.
You just haven't placed your running shoes by the door to trigger the cue activation, or your internal accountant is misweighting the cold weather. You are fighting a structural bottleneck, not a character deficit.
This raises an important question regarding how society views productivity. It removes the shame entirely.
It really does.
If you aren't taking action, you don't need to attack your core character. You need to debug your system. Are you missing procedural knowledge? Do you need better environmental cues? Or do you need to artificially lower the immediate aversive costs, maybe by putting on warmer clothes so the action gate will open? You have to engineer the transfer, not just wish for it with willpower.
So to bring this all together, our mission today was to shatter that old conveyor belt illusion. And I think we have left it in pieces on the factory floor.
I'd say so.
We've seen that your mind is this incredibly dynamic, coupled ecosystem. Selection doesn't guarantee observation, and observation doesn't guarantee an update.
And we established that memory is a transversal interface, touching every single part of this grid, actively reconstructing your reality in real time.
And we learned that getting stuck isn't about ignoring information, it's about that trap of high activation and low plasticity driven by identity defense. And finally, that feeling to act isn't a lack of willpower, it's a mechanical break in the knowledge action transfer chain. You now have a completely new lens to view your own mind, to diagnose your own bottlenecks, and to engineer your own environment for success.
Knowledge is most valuable when it is deeply understood and practically applied. By mapping your own cognitive city grid, you can stop fighting against your nature and start optimizing it.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to mull over.
Oh, I like those.
We spent a lot of time talking about how memory isn't a filing cabinet, but a cross-layer interface that reconstructs the past based on your current internal state and your current goals. Well, if that's true, then every single time you change your mind about who you are today, every time you shift your identity or your worldview, you are literally neurologically rewriting your own past. The memories you retrieve tomorrow will be structurally different from the ones you retrieved yesterday, simply because the you doing the retrieving has changed. So the question is, when you look back at that city grid of your life, what version of your past are you actively reconstructing right now? Thank you for joining us on this journey through the mind. We'll see you next time.